announcement of a film in which I'm interviewing Krishnamurti. I was asked on one occasion to do an hour's filmed interview, and they gave me a print of it. And I thought, you know, being this close to the source himself, why this might be an interesting time, a place to show that. And if they ever arrive, who knows where those films along with my bag are, but presumably they are in Santa Barbara or will reach there. And if they get out this afternoon, then this,
yeah, we'll send someone to pick them up.
If they won't bring them, but we'll see. We hope they will bring them. But anyway, now that will be this evening, right?
Right.
And will it be here?
In here.
Okay. And then tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. And if I catch a 5:15 plane from Santa Barbara, I can have dinner tomorrow evening with my children and grandchildren, and 4 hours at the San Francisco airport before I have to go back. And so, with your indulgence, why I will phase out a little earlier than usual. I think it typically goes to about 5. But if anybody is compulsive about schedule, and I think I've not encountered a less compulsive place than this, but I brought along another film, my last film, which is on India and the Infinite, and that would be here in case anybody wants to linger and run out the clock according to legal stipulations.
We're going to keep that as a permanent recording.
Now, I thought that this morning, until there will be a gong or something rung for lunch, that we would simply talk about Gnosticism in general. And then this afternoon, we would move our discussion over into Christian Gnosticism. Now let me say there that there is also a Jewish Gnosticism, and this comes out mainly in the Kabbalah, of which I know a little something, but I sense that there are two or three here that probably know more about that than I. It just occurred to me that when I was passing around that finger rosary, that for those in the Jewish tradition, not only could this cross, which ecumenically here is of equal dimensions, the two arms, could represent the Garden of Eden, but these the 10 beads could be the 10 Sephiroth of the Kabbalah. So it could function equally there. Well, my emphasis this afternoon will be on the relation of Gnosticism to Christianity, or in short, Christian Gnosticism. But because I haven't done any serious work in the other, but I hope that in our discussions that we'll be making cross-references, and those of you who do know the Kabbalah will chime in with cross-references there. And then tomorrow morning, actually during the day, we would talk about the subtitle of this workshop. Remember, as my copy of the stated text, you know, the contract that brought us here, namely what I said we would do, is again in my bag somewhere, so I'm pretty vague on that. But I think it said, Gnosticism, a Western path towards Asia. And in the fine print underneath, it said that to note these similarities, that Christianity and Buddhism would be compared, noting the points of convergence between them. So I thought tomorrow we would move on to that final stay. Now we can see how things develop, but that is the trajectory that I have in mind. Is that okay? I see nods. Well, let's begin with some books. Needleman's Lost Christianity. I see I have only the pre-publication copy of it, but how many of you know the name Needleman? Everybody, practically. And how many know this book, either having read it or know, having read about it? Well, it tells of meeting a Coptic monk in, of all places, a Rangoon airport or something, where weather or snarl in flights has grounded them for 24 hours. And they get into this fascinating discussion of what would really be Gnostic Christianity. And here he's surprised to find a living exemplar. And then they split, and a year and a half later, he gets a letter saying that the monk has died and bequeathed him this manuscript. So he goes to the manuscript and calls it out. It's all a hoax. There never was such a man. It's like the Piltdown Man, except, you know, I'm not faulting Needleman. It's a device. The Tibetans would call it upaya, skillful means. But it reads better if you think that Syrian monk actually lived. And it's fiction, but it's imaginative in the best sense. And I think it's a good book. In fact, I think if I had the publication copy, if they printed what I sent in, I said I thought it was probably Needleman's best book. Because he does bring out, put his finger in a very discerning way on the Gnostic strand within Christianity, which has become lost. So even though it's fiction, nevertheless, I include it in the books related to this seminar.
Does that mean that Jacob Needleman didn't know what was going on?
No, he invented the whole thing. He never was in Rangoon. But it's done so well that, you know, it took me about, I don't know how long, a little while, a couple of weeks or a couple of months before I did the double take on this, you know.
Explain this to Gander anyway.
No. It's just pulled off.
Right. Sort of thing. Yeah. A lot of good stuff, but
it's okay.
Okay.
Does he know you know?
Oh yes, I think now the reviewers were took it in less charitable spirit than I did.
It's done in ancient times more than, wasn't it? I mean, even in the Christians' writings, maybe in the first couple of centuries, people would write things and put somebody else's name on them and all kinds of things.
Oh, that was a very venerable practice to write things. I guess the classic case is Dionysus the Areopagite, who, 5th century or something, and I guess I'm persuaded by the textual analysis of that that it could not have been before the 5th century, but he claims that it was written, he signs it, Dionysus, who is a disciple of St. Paul. Yeah. But there was a totally different attitude about that, which borders more on self-effacement, you know. We are so invested in what we write, so much ego in it, Oh, I heard a sort of joke last week, kind of a joke. Two friends meet after 30 years they've been apart, and you know, they're catching up, they were together in graduate school and so on, and one of them realizes that he's done all the talking, says, "Okay, enough about me, let's talk about you. What do you think of my last book?" Perfect, you know, just perfect. So that's our attitude towards, but this was a kind of sublime anonymity. The person who produced this astonishing, I think, in Western Christian literature after the New Testament, that is the peak for me. That's the most profound single statement. And yet the person who wrote that was just completely content to just efface himself. Now, the other side of it, why did he claim this? Maybe it was a way of saying that he felt that he was in the spirit of Dionysus or something in writing this.
Wasn't it also a little bit revolutionary according to the
oh, you're right.
Of the day?
You're right.
In those days, you didn't perhaps want to be very revolutionary.
That's very good. That's right. You didn't have a chance. There's another interesting difference. We take such pride in originality, you know, being original. Everybody wants to be original. I discovered it. Well, in the past, they did too, but original had a very different meaning coming from the source. You know, that's what they prized, that it came from the source. And therefore, nothing had a chance of being accepted if it were new. Everything of value comes from the source. And therefore, you have to make your case that it is connected with the source for people to take it seriously. And you're quite right. This is one of the reasons why I place it at the top, is because it's probably the most mystical tract ever written in Christianity. And mysticism has had a hard time in Christianity. As Niebuhr used to say, and I never miss an opportunity to hold this against him, he said, mysticism begins in mist, you know, fuzzy thinking, centers in I, ego, and ends in schism. So much for mysticism. But this is a mystical text, so this person had, the mystics had to use skillful means, upaya, to get their truths even looked at. So you're, thank you for bringing that in. That was a useful addition. All right. The Nag Hammadi Library is the basic text now in Christian Gnosticism. 1945, this dramatic story, I forget the particulars, but this Egyptian farmer digging comes on this jar. No, throwing a stone. I get it mixed up with a Dead Sea Scroll. Anyway, it's all told very graphically, and in a few pages pick it up during the 2 days. Part of it was used as fire? I mean, just to warm themselves? But somehow somebody saw it who thought it might have merit. And somehow it got to this acquaintance of that Joan and mine, Kispel, the New Testament and patristic scholar in from the Netherlands, who was astonished when he, of course, can read Coptic, when he opened, these were manuscripts, when he read, let me just read you the opening line. These are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke. You know, your hair begins to go on. And the secret words that Jesus, the living Jesus, spoke. And Thomas wrote them down. Now, Thomas is the disciple who, according to tradition, went to India. So again, the Western path towards Asia, the way in which this Gnostic perspective, there's a meeting of these two hemispheres, which Jung, of course, said are the two hemispheres of the human consciousness. Asia, he said, is the West's unconscious. And here, therefore, this intersection. And then as he went on to read, and tomorrow when we're on, or maybe this afternoon, on Christian Gnosticism, I intend to read some passages, and about half of it is duplicates the New Testament, the Gospels, the teachings. You'll recognize them with only a word or two change. But the other half, these mind-blowing and very different accent. But now the scholars think that these manuscripts, the manuscripts themselves only go back to the 5th century, but these scholars of texts, these detectives of the text are fantastic in their repertoire of devices. I don't know how they do it. It's like the physical anthropologists who find a tooth, you know, and they reconstruct a whole skeleton out of a tooth or something like that. The kind of microscopic precision and expertise. Well, this manuscript is now traced back, and some think to the middle of the first century, which would put it earlier even than the four Gospels. So it goes right back there, and what it opens up is the fact that Christianity in the first 30, 40 years after the death of Jesus was far more pluralistic. The Chinese have the phrase, let a thousand, hundred flowers bloom, that there were 100 Christian flowers, you know, blooming there. And our vision has contracted, and we think of it as a kind of a single plant, but it was far more pluralistic. And the exciting prospect, of course, is that this opens the aperture of our knowledge to a vastly richer field of primitive Christianity than we had suspected and which we have lost sight of. Anyway, that's sort of looking ahead. But the texts now have been translated by an international team of scholars, and this is the standard book on it. Then Elaine Pagels has done a brilliant job of popularization. Very able. She got into it in the doctoral program, New Testament Studies, in the 60s at Harvard Divinity School. Went on, now is teaching at Barnard College. And there's a kind of exquisite appropriateness that the leading popularization or dissemination of this is coming through a woman, because the feminine emphasis was one of the distinctive emphases of the Gnostic. Readily available, won the National Book Critics Award. Splendid book. This goes back to Gnosticism itself before the discovery, before the discovery of the Nag Hammadi manuscript, but at least they were not known because it took a lot of time. I wish I knew the specifics because it's a marvelous yarn of drama in it. Including, and this is the point now, international, I started to say intrigue, but not exactly that, but blockages. Yeah, you couldn't get, who's going to have the rights to these, and who would have access to them, and who would be permitted to see them, and it got into high diplomacy, which slowed the whole thing down. So this was the first one, really, to hit the consciousness, and what's the date of this? Well, it goes back to 1959. That shows how slow I am in coming on to it. I didn't come on to it till about 1965, I think. Well, this book comes well before that. Kind of classic about what we'll be spending the balance of the morning talking about, namely Gnosticism in general, before we go on to look at Christian Gnosticism. Those I think of as the... Oh, and this one, of course, is a kind of New Testament of Christian Gnosticism. I think the single most beautiful testament of Christian Gnosticism. All right. Now, let's go to Gnosticism per se. In workshops, I never use notes, except this is a first for me. I'm being prodded into new areas providentially. And so I haven't assimilated all this material. And so this will be useful for me. Let's start with the word itself, Gnosticism. And a lot of people know, most people, maybe everybody here knows this. What's the meaning of the word itself?
Well, I thought, but I might be incorrect, it meant knowledge attained at the threshold of ecstasy.
Well, that's a beautiful definition, and that's a marvelous definition. But I think that's the kind of peak definition, and therefore I think we have a need for a more comprehensive that wouldn't limit it to that. Because that is the ultimate mode of knowledge. But how many are privy to that gem-like ultimate? Maybe all of us to a greater degree than we recognize.
I think more and more every day.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right. Like Maslow, once he gave a name to peak experience, everybody found out to their surprise that they had had them.
How would it be if we call it experiential knowledge as opposed to knowledge that is passed on by those in authority?
All right, that has a valid element to it, too. I think these are both true. I'm going to suggest yet another way, and from this pool, You know, there's no one way to do it, but these are elements and emphases. If anybody want to suggest yet another one? I think of it as saving knowledge. Knowledge that saves. Now, you know, there is another kind. Knowledge that not only does not do one whit towards saving, but could even clutter. You know? The mind can be jammed with so much irrelevant that it can get in our way. So this is knowledge of a very special kind. It has nothing to do with the Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, kind of warehouse of information. Who could top the other in a quiz program? Nothing to do with factual knowledge. And nor any more than it has to do with kind of mental dexterity of a calculator sort.
Yeah. When you say saving knowledge, are you talking about saving in the Judeo-Christian Islamic?
Well, certainly I'm talking about that, but I'm not sure that I would end the list there. Let's include Sun Bear. Goes without saying. But let's leave the word salvation undefined, just generously open-ended, and see, there is this other kind of knowledge I think of Jesus' statement, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. All right, that freedom is salvation. And it's that kind of knowledge. It's a kind of knowledge that grasps us and transports us to where it is. So you are not left where you were. And this kind of knowledge obviously is not limited to words. In fact, one of the Gnostic emphases is going to be that when you get time, this ecstatic knowledge that Joan moved in on so fast. When you get to that, you can't put it in words. But it certainly is not limited to words. And another way of saying that is that words are not its only vehicle. Art, for example, and in this case it would be sacred art, is a channel of knowing just as much as propositions, texts, and the like. See, and let's just dwell on that for a moment to get really a clean grasp on this kind of knowledge. Stay with sacred art. You know, the marvelous thing about sacred art is that it lifts us to its state of beauty. And when we are in that state, we surpass ourselves. I mean, in the sense that we are generous, we are loving, all those kinds of things come naturally to us when we're in that state. Alas, we can't hold it, so we go back. So, you might almost say it does our spiritual work for us. Anyway, in doing that, there is we know. See, that's a kind of knowing that transports, that elevates, that saves. Okay, so much for the root word, Gnosticism, derives from that word. And if we want an inclusive definition, then Gnosticism would be that spiritual perspective which centers in the claim that knowledge saves. Maybe I could do better leaving out the claim. Gnosticism is that spiritual perspective that centers in saving knowledge. Okay. Now, as such, it's wonderful, isn't it? My spirit lights up. So why all these bad marks, these slings and arrows, this bad press that it has gotten down the ages? Well, I think there's a good reason and a bad reason. Let's start with the bad reason. The bad reason is it comes back to human fallibility, and it has to do with power politics. It has to do with prejudice. All of which distills to two points. One is power politics, and we'll get into that when we talk about Christian Gnosticism and Elaine Pagel's theory about that it was actively suppressed. And let's just jump ahead to the key point there. It was actively suppressed for the reason, the emphasis that I read in the prayer circle out there, namely, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Now, we have that in the regular New Testament, but that's not really what the Greek says in that. It is the kingdom of heaven is in your midst, which is something a little bit different. But to say it's within you, that makes you, in a way, the ultimate source of appeal. But that's anti-hierarchical institutional, and the lid's off. You know, the Holy Spirit can effervesce anywhere, and that plays havoc with institutions. So Elaine Pagel said that's it was forcibly, and it was denounced as heresy and so on. That's why. But so the power politics aspect was one reason why it got the bad name. But there is a more profound reason, and that really doesn't throw stones at anybody, bishops or whoever. It is simply the incapacity to understand what was being said. And I think that is the real reason, or the deeper reason. These two things playing together were the chief reasons why. The bad reasons, they're unfortunate. One wishes that they were not there. But we're still on the point of why did it get a bad press, and there was one very good reason, I think, in the sense that it deserved it. And that good reason is that there is a tendency within Gnosticism to a sharp dualism between good and evil. Some things are good, other things are bad, but just really a pronounced dualism with, now here's where the really bad part came, with a severe derogation of the world. We have to get a better word than derogation. Put down of matter and the physical existence. This is a veil of sin and tears, a negative view on this world, meaning including in that our life in this world. Now, whereas our hearts all rose with when we're talking about saving knowledge, I suspect that our hearts all deflate when we talk about this negative view of life in this world. I mean, Ojai is beautiful. The sun shines after the winds slam in. And so are we together on that point too?
I suppose I want to say something there. That is a criticism that appears certainly to be valid on the surface. It's the one that's always touted. And certainly there are Gnostic documents that point very wholeheartedly in that direction. But in many other of the Gnostic documents, it appears to me that what they're talking about is not the wickedness of this material world, but the lack of a person's ability to see it as both. In other words, when you were introducing yourself and saying who you were, your work, God, and family, it occurred to me that from a Gnostic point of view, that possibly there would be no difference, there'd be no conflict, no blame. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't want to belabor the point, because there's certainly a lot of evidence to justify what you said.
Right.
But there are other documents that seem to point to a different view. In other words, yeah, the world, just as a mechanical clockwork, is perhaps what they were talking about, without seeing the great depth that it also contains.
Yes. Well, I think you're right, Myron, to alert us to the danger that this bad press has been undiscriminating in this area. And it is true that when I read this as a Gnostic document, I don't sense anything of that note within it. But okay. Nevertheless, I stay with the generalization that if one took Gnosticism or Gnostic literature, I started to say as a whole, it has a world-negating character to it. That's what I'm tempted to say, but when I say Gnostic literature as a whole, I've just sounded here and there in it. And so let's just leave it that there's certainly that comes out very strongly in certain very important Gnostic texts. But let's remember that it was not universal. And so let's not tar the whole thing with that point. Now, I find it useful to have a semantic, a verbal way of making this distinction between, what should we say, good Gnosticism and bad Gnosticism, to fall into a dualism, which for practical purposes is still useful. And but they're both Gnosticism, so we have to use the same word. But let's do it by capitalizing the Gnosticism as a point of view which included this negative evaluation of the world. But leave it with a small g when we're talking about the basic element in Gnosticism, namely this emphasis on saving knowledge. Yeah. I said, let's do it that way. I don't care how you do it. Why should you follow that? But that's the way I do it. And, okay, I said, that's the way. So when I talk about Gnosticism, when I write it myself with a large G, it includes this heavily dualistic, pejorative view of the world. But when I'm talking about a point of view that emphasizes saving knowledge, I just use that's a Gnostic with a small g. By the way, on that saving knowledge, we're talking about a Western way to Asia. In Asia, that would be, I think I used the word, I said I was a jhana yogin, the way to God through knowledge. And that contrasts with the bhakti yoga, which is the way to God through love. It's only a provisional difference, as we know, because the further one goes, the jhanic finds himself loving what he knows, and the bhakti finds herself knowing what she loved. Sex is interposed. So it converges in the same, but along the way there is a difference of emphasis. So one could equally say that the Gnostic strand in Western religions is the jhanic strand. It is the jhana yoga of the West. If anybody doesn't understand, we use throw around terms and vocabularies differ. So if I use any terms that you don't understand, why just ask me to define them. Neil, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, there are four. These are the basic divisions between jhana and bhakti, but then there's karma, the way of work. And then there's Raj, the way of psychophysical exercises. That would be the full panoply. All right. Let's go then, having identified what Gnosticism is, to do two other things. Namely, what were its basic tenets or beliefs or principles? And the other thing would be its major manifestations, as in Mani and Manichaeanism and so on the like. But let's begin with what were the, if we were beyond this definition, if we were to say what were its beliefs? Basic beliefs. All right, and let me divide these into five. Speaking about its theology, and then we'll go on to its cosmology, and then its anthropology or view of the human self, and then we'll go on to its soteriology or view of salvation, and fifthly, its morality, its ethics. Okay, very quickly. I think we can pull out we can dub in the basic beliefs. Okay. Now, on the theology, again, this God is very other than the world. Here is the dualism coming in. So a huge emphasis on transcendence, weak on immanence. Now, there is an element of because if you had an absolutely torn apart, then they'd never get together again and there'd be no hope. But a very sharp divide. God is the antithesis of the world, the opposite of the world. Now, so other than the world that he really doesn't get mixed up in it, and that means that creation is relegated to a subordinate creator. So the notion God created the heavens and the earth, no, it's too bad. He would never have done nothing like that. If it got done as some of his lordlings or something, that ultimately gets its power from God, but God is removed. The actual creation and governance of the world is in the hands of subordinate creatures, and they're known as archons, or rulers. We won't introduce many technical terms, but A-R-C-H-O-N-S, for those of you who have pencils going. And it means, as I say, simply rulers. And these archons themselves are children of darkness. You know, they